broader political negotiations.
Professor, you mentioned Eritrea. Of course, they play a critical role in this war, but they were not included in the negotiations. We just have 30 seconds. If you could explain the significance of that.
Well, I mean, officially, Eritrea has not admitted to being a party to the war, even though we all know that there are Eritrean troops fighting alongside the Ethiopians. I imagine that to the extent to which Addis Ababa, which is in a strategic alliance with Asmara, adheres to the agreement that has just been reached, it will indeed be able to transfer the full effects of the ceasefire to the authorities in Asmara.
Well, Adebayo Olokoshi, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Distinguished research professor at the Wits School of Governance in Johannesburg, previously serves as director of the African Social Science Council and the UN African Institute for Economic Development and Planning, speaking to us from Johannesburg, South Africa. Again, tune in on November 8th for our three-hour midterm election night special. We'll be broadcasting live starting at 9 p.m. Eastern. You can go to democracynow.org for more information. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a video news production fellowship and a people and culture manager. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO. Portland.
A date which will live in infamy.
Tune in to KBOO on election night, Tuesday, November 8th at 6 p.m. for our live midterm election coverage. We'll have coverage that counts from local, county, state, and national races. Our anchors will be with you while the vote tallies come in, and we'll also feature analysis from your favorite KBOO hosts. That's KBOO's live midterm election coverage starting at 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 8th. Don't miss it.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shwaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants with the forming of relationships to each other and the living world.
Rise them up, KBOO 90.7. You don't know it's your girl, Tasha T.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, Gendered Resistance, Women's Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner, a collection of stories inspired by the escaped slave, Margaret Garner, who killed her own daughter rather than have her returned to slavery. We speak with Professor of History at Miami University in Ohio, Mary Fredrickson. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnestead. The Federal Reserve is expected to announce another interest rate hike today after its meeting ends. The anticipated 0.75 percentage point increase will be its sixth interest rate hike to tame inflation and will still lead to higher loan rates for many businesses and consumers. It's already sent borrowing rates surging across the economy and heightened the risk of a recession. Chronic inflation has also become a central point of attack for Republicans against Democrats. Democrats in the midterm congressional election. With just days ahead of the midterm elections, President Joe Biden campaigned in Florida yesterday, where he touted his legislative victories, including on health care and the economy, and he warned of Republican obstruction if Democrats lose seats in the upcoming elections. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden flew to Hallandale Beach, Florida, Tuesday. He says he came to talk about two very, very, very important programs.
And they're under siege by our Republican friends. Social Security and Medicare are the two things I want to talk about.
Biden touted some of his recent legislative accomplishments working with Democratic lawmakers, such as measures that capped some health care costs for Medicare and prescription drugs, and other efforts to deal with inflation and the economy. But Biden says those accomplishments, and more, are at stake in the midterm elections coming up in just a week.
If Republicans in the Congress have their way, the power we just gave Medicare to negotiate prescription drug prices goes away, gone. $2,000 cap on prescription drugs, gone.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The man accused of breaking into House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's San Francisco home and beating her husband with a hammer entered a plea of not guilty in San Francisco Superior Court yesterday. A judge ordered him held without bail. Eileen Alfandari has more.
San Francisco District Attorney Brooke Jenkins called David DePapp a very dangerous man.
Not only is this someone who engaged in a pre-planned attack on the speaker in her home, but someone who was willing to enact violence that was politically motivated. And so, yes, we certainly view him as a public safety risk to the city of San Francisco, certainly to the speaker.
A court filing says DePapp told police he was on a suicide mission, seeking to kidnap Nancy Pelosi, and had plans to target a local professor, other California and federal politicians. They have not been named. In the court filing, prosecutors said Paul Pelosi was knocked unconscious by the hammer attack and woke up in a pool of his own blood. The filing also said that DePapp told officers and medics at the scene that he was sick of the lies coming out of Washington, D.C. DePapp's social media posts and pages are no longer accessible, but they were filled with right-wing conspiracy theories about QAnon, Pizzagate, and racist and anti-Semitic posts. Right-wing conspiracy theorists have claimed DePapp was Paul Pelosi's lover in the attack, a lover's quarrel. DePapp is scheduled to return to court on Friday. I'm Eileen Alfandari.
Former President Barack Obama campaigned in Nevada yesterday for Democratic Senator Catherine Cortez Masto, who faces a Trump-backed Republican challenger, Adam Laxalt. He's a former state attorney general who helped promulgate the big lie that the 2020 presidential election was stolen from Trump by pushing false claims of voter fraud. He also downplayed the deadly January 6th Capitol insurrection by Trump's followers. Obama, while talking up Democrats' vision, also linked political violence to right-wing rhetoric.
Demonizing political opponents creates a dangerous climate. And elected officials who do not explicitly reject, if they just ignore or make light of that kind of violence, or if they encourage their supporters to stand outside voting places armed with guns and dressed in tactical gear, if that's the environment that we create, more people are going to get hurt. And we will be violating the basic spirit of who we are as a people.
He said he spoke to Paul Pelosi recently, who was recovering from a politically motivated attack. The Associated Press is reporting aides to former President Trump are making quiet preparations for a 2024 presidential campaign that could be launched soon after next week's midterm elections. Trump will try to capitalize on expected Republican wins to propel himself toward becoming the front runner for his party's nomination. Former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu appears to be heading towards victory in the country's national elections, as some 85% of ballots have been counted and show voters gave him and his far-right allies what looks like a stable majority in the country's parliament. Although votes are still being counted and results are not finalized, Israel's likely headed to its most right-wing government, bolstered by a strong showing from the ultra-nationalist religious Zionism Party, whose members use inflammatory anti-Arab and anti-LGBTQ rhetoric.
Russia's defense minister says it's agreed to return to a Turkish and United Nations brokered deal that allows the shipment of millions of tons of Ukrainian grain through the Black Sea port. Russia suspended its participation over the weekend, citing allegations of a drone attack against its Black Sea fleet by Ukraine. I'm Christina Onnestad, reporting for Pacifica Radio.
We now go to our discussion, recently recorded, with Professor of History at Miami University, Mary Fredrickson. She's one of the editors of a new anthology, Gendered Resistance, Women, Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner. Our guest is Mary E. Fredrickson. She is one of the editors, along with Dolores M. Walters, of a brand new book, Gendered Resistance, Women, Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner. Of course, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. So, Mary, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Mary, before we get into some of the stories covered in this anthology, to have some context here for our listeners, I'd like to discuss a bit breeding states, because a lot of people are not aware of breeding states, and I think it really helps to give some sense of reality of what it was like. And tell us what you know. What can you share with us about these breeding states?
Well, I think one of the things that we wanted to look at in this particular volume were the stories of women who had been enslaved and who had been enslaved in a sexualized way. And we focused on the story of Margaret Garner, which was and is really an archetypal story in the history of slavery. One of the books that followed Toni Morrison's Beloved, which of course is a fictional story of Margaret Garner's life, is a book called Modern Medea. And I think that Margaret Garner really, in many ways, was a modern Medea. I think the Margaret Garner story illustrates the breeding states. Probably Kentucky may not even be on that list of breeding states. States where, in fact, slave owners were having impregnating slave women on a regular basis to increase the number of slaves. I would argue that it happened in every state where slavery occurred. I think we have historical evidence that happened across the board. And the Margaret Garner story certainly illustrates that. I mean, she bore several children who historical evidence indicates were fathered by, if you can use that word, where the master had impregnated her. The stories in Gendered Resistance really revolve around the issue of sexual slavery. And I think that we see that for a number of reasons. One is sexual pleasure, one is sexual control, and probably the most significant is for reproduction. But I think that, you know, we can point to certain states where this may have been done in a more systematic way or even a more legalized way. But we can argue, I think, without any question, that this was done in every state where enslaved women were held.
I also wanted, before again getting into the Margaret Garner specific story, the general story of enslaved women and some of the challenges that they faced that perhaps were not faced, at least not in the same way, as the men.
We do know a great deal about the abuse of women slaves, and particularly the sexual abuse of women slaves. I think that enslaved women in American history, and I say it sort of drawing out those words because I think that as we learn more and more about the history of slavery, one of the things that we know is that it changes. it changes over time, and it changes from the 1600s to the 1700s to the 1800s. And then, as we know, it's changed yet again in the 1900s and in the 21st century. Women have faced a different set of circumstances as enslaved people. And this has often turned on intimate, sexualized violence of women and abuse of women, use of women, as I said, for pleasure, for control, and for reproduction. I think it's a very difficult thing for scholars to look at. I think it's a very difficult thing for the public to look at. I think it's a challenging area to address, to deal with. And if we talk about the historical imagination, I think for us it's often difficult to even imagine the level of torture and abuse that women faced and dealt with during enslavement.
Another challenge that actually is mentioned quite a bit in this anthology has to do with mothers' concern for their children. I mean, even the children that were born basically as a result of rape, of women being forced to acquiesce or having to acquiesce to this for a number of reasons, including protecting their children. But in looking at the numbers of men who were able to escape in greater numbers than the women, it seems to me as though I've heard so many stories that because of their concern for their children, that women often then try to escape in groups and figure out ways in which to escape with their children and other loved ones. So, and that wasn't necessarily a key consideration, or I'm sure it was a consideration, but in a different intensity for the men.
We have evidence of women who escaped. You know, someone like Harriet Tubman, who escaped and came back again and again. I think we probably have underestimated the number of women who did escape with their children, often hiding them. There's evidence of women giving children laudanum or morphine to quiet their cries, to make sure they were asleep during an escape. But the fact of the matter is, I think you're absolutely correct. It made it more challenging and difficult for women to escape. No question about that.
And it really points to the caregiving work that women always seem to be doing. And I thought, as I was reading some of these stories, I also thought of women who are in prison today. Women, single mothers, are the fastest growing population in the United States of people going into prison, although the numbers-wise, the majority are men, I guess similar to the slave situation. And so many of those mothers are then trying to, from their prison cell, you know, find out about their children or somehow be involved in the caregiving of their children. And the same for immigrant mothers who today, with the immigration laws, you know, separating families in such a tragic way. And in some instances, immigrant mothers being forced to basically give up their children, their American-born children, to foster care, to adoption, when they are deported across the border. So we can see this thread.
Absolutely. And one of the chapters in our anthology on gendered resistance by psychologist Kathy McDaniels Wilson deals with the psychological after effects of racialized sexual violence. And she bases this article on interviews she's done with over 800 imprisoned women in the state of Ohio. And she did these interviews over the last 5 or 6 years. So we're very much concerned in this anthology with working to make, to draw connections across time and look at the historical context for gendered resistance and also the contemporary context.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Mary E. Fredrickson, and she is one of the editors, along with Dolores M. Walters, of a new book entitled Gendered Resistance, Women, Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner, part of the series on slavery that we have been doing here on our show. So let us then get into Margaret Garner. Her name is in the title. Let's get into her story. For people who don't know who Margaret Garner is, tell us some of her background and what happened to her. We'll talk a little bit about the impact of her trial, but first just on her and her family.
All right. Well, Margaret Garner was a slave woman who was born in the early part of the 19th century. She came of age on living on a plantation that was about 19 miles south of Cincinnati, Ohio, on the Kentucky side of the Ohio River. She lived there with her children and her mother. She had married, although her marriage was not legally recognized. She had a husband named Robert Garner, and they together had one child, and she had several other children who we know from the census were marked by the color of their skin. So her first child, which we believe was conceived with her husband, was recorded in the census as being black. Several of her subsequent children were recorded as being mulatto.
Tell us the difference then at that time between black and mulatto.
These tend to be relatively imprecise categories, but basically we feel pretty certain that her eldest son was conceived with her husband because it looked like he was had two parents who were African American. The children who were mulatto were of mixed parentage, probably half African American and half white. Many slave owners often turn to their slave women to have sexual relations at times when their wives were pregnant. Dolores Walters, in her wonderful introduction about Margaret Garner in our anthology, correlated the times when the slave owner's wife was pregnant with the times that Margaret Garner had born these mixed-race children.
Right. So then tell us about Margaret Garner's plan to escape and what happened.
Okay. She made a plan with her husband, who at the time was working on a nearby plantation, and with his parents and with a number of other family members and friends who were in the area. Was a group of about 17 altogether who made a decision to escape, going across the Ohio River on a sled. And it was in January. It was one of the coldest winters ever on record in Cincinnati. When Margaret Garner and her family members escaped, they knew they would only stay in Cincinnati temporarily, and then they would have to go further north. And in order to escape from slavery in the U.S., they would in fact have to go into Canada. So her family was planning to go to Cincinnati, get into Ohio, but just stay there for a short period of time until they could be transported north.
Basically, they were caught.
They were caught.
So this is the big sensation. Our listeners may not know that story. So tell us what happened during that capture.
They successfully crossed the river. The river was frozen that night and quite solidly, and they were able to go across, get to the other side. and they went to what they thought was a safe house where they could stay the night before, or probably stay for a couple of days before they left to go further north. The master of Margaret Garner's plantation left the plantation, got federal marshals to cross the river, meet them in Cincinnati. They tracked the family. They went to the house where they were staying. They burst into the house. They had guns. They had weapons of all kinds, and they captured the family, and they arrested them. They were arrested by the marshals, and it was at that moment that Margaret Garner made the fateful decision to kill one of her children, her young daughter Mary, rather than have this child return to slavery.
Was her intention to kill only that child, or did it ever emerge if her intention was really to kill all of her children rather than have them spend a life enslaved?
Well, apparently the intention was to kill all of the children. She was not able to do that.
Right.
She had two sons with her and the baby. As I say, she was also pregnant at the time. This young child was described as very light skin with rosy cheeks. There was discussion about the slave owner being incredibly upset at the death of this child. All of that, though, I say in with a bit of hesitation, because whose mouth those words came out of, we are not sure.
Yeah, and you know, of course, that story and the impact of her trial, there was great interest in her trial and a lot of people being appalled by that. But certainly we had heard of stories before, even of women who were enslaved and giving birth on slave ships, fundamentally making the decision to kill themselves and their children rather than be enslaved. But Margaret Garner's story is certainly a very dramatic instance of that, and the fact that the trial itself was, you know, such a sensation. Tell us a bit about the impact of it. And then I also want to, before we leave the Margaret Garner story, looking at the clock, I do want to get more in depth about Elizabeth Clark Gaines. But Toni Morrison, the Nobel laureate, in her book Beloved, a lot of people make the contrast and the comparison with the story she tells in Beloved, where Seth, one of the characters, kills a child, and that it's portrayed as a kind of a mercy killing, Mary.
Absolutely. Right, absolutely. And, you know, Toni Morrison based the story Beloved on the Margaret Garner case. She read of the Margaret Garner case actually in a wonderful book of documents called Black Women in White America, which her historian Gerda Lerner edited back in the early 70s. It came out, I think, in 1972. And Toni Morrison, everyone was using that book. I can see it on my shelf now. But Gerda Lerner put these documents together. And one of the documents she included in that book was a very short piece from one of the Cincinnati papers about the Margaret Garner case. And Toni Morrison said later that she had read that story, it had resonated with her, and that then she wrote the book Beloved based on that story. So I think that, you know, Seth, the character of Seth, clearly is based on the Margaret Garner story. I wanted to say I have the Cincinnati papers, the New York papers, were just filled with articles about the Margaret Garner trial. I have one of the clippings here, and it says, from January 29th, arrest of fugitive slaves. A slave mother murders her child rather than see it return to slavery. And the article begins, great excitement existed throughout the city the whole of yesterday in consequence of the arrest of a party of slaves and the murder of her child by a slave mother while the officers were in the act of making the arrest. Another one goes, stampede of slaves, a tale of horror, an arrest by the U.S. Marshal, a deputy U.S. Marshal shot, a Negro child's throat cut from ear to ear by its father or mother, and others wounded. So, you know, there, by its father or mother, that's a curious and tantalizing headline. I think there was a lot of sensationalism around the case, around the arrest, around the death of the child, and around the trial itself. The trial went on for quite a long time. People filled the streets. You wonder how people had so much time on their hands, but every morning when Margaret Garner was brought from the jail to the courthouse, the streets were lined with people curious to see her. People followed this trial. It was, for many, many years, it was maybe forever, it was the most infamous trial around slavery in the country.
Yeah, and ironically, and Dolores Walters, who co-edited this book with you, I mean, she writes that, and I find it really ironic that Margaret Garner wasn't tried for her child's murder, but that the judge, who was then a federal commissioner, overruled the state's right to prosecute for murder, but upheld the fugitive slave law, right? The Fugitive Slave Act supporting slavery, and that the family was then sent back to Kentucky.
Well, yes, and even more than that, there was a fight between the state of Ohio and the state of Kentucky about what to do with Margaret Garner. Ohio wanted to try her for murder. Now, there was an irony there because they wanted to try her for murder, and one of the rationales for that was that if she was tried for murder, she could be kept in the state of Ohio and not returned to slavery. Cincinnati in particular, Ohio in as a, the state, but Cincinnati was so close to Kentucky, so 1,000 feet across the river, and you were in, depending on which way you were going, you were either in a free state or a slave state. And abolitionists in Kentucky, and national abolitionists, one of them was Lucy Stone, who was a suffragist and an abolitionist. She came to Cincinnati for the trial. In fact, she was the one person who pointed out the sexual abuse of Margaret Garner and the sexual slavery in which Margaret Garner had been held. So there was a struggle between the state of Ohio wanting to try her for murder, partially as a way to keep her in Ohio in a free state and not have her sent back into slavery, versus Kentucky, where the argument was that she could not be tried for murder because she was enslaved. And in fact, she would have to be charged with destruction of property.
Yeah, so that was how they thought of that baby, you know, more as property. Our guest is Mary Fredrickson. She, along with Dolores M. Walters, they have edited a new book entitled Gendered Resistance, Women's Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner. And we've been talking about Margaret Garner, known for having killed one of her children rather than having her child return to slavery after she escaped and was caught. What I would like to do now is to go on and discuss a bit. I'm looking at the clock and there are like at least 3 other things. There were like maybe 10 other things I wanted to talk with you about, Mary, but the time is flying, to talk a bit about the story of Elizabeth Clark Gaines, because she waited and waited and was quite patient in plotting and planning to not only get out of slavery herself, but for her children. Could you sum that up for us?
Well, this is an incredible story of an incredible woman that is included in the essay that I wrote for the book. I called it A Mother's Arithmetic, and it's really Elizabeth Clark Gaines' journey from slavery to freedom. Elizabeth Clark Gaines crossed the same river that Margaret Garner did almost 40 years before Margaret Garner's crossing. Elizabeth Clark Gaines crossed the Ohio to freedom in Ohio in 1817. And she is a woman who was born in Virginia in the late 18th century. And then she, in 1783, actually, and she was named Betty, which actually was the most common slave name for girl children. And she was brought to Kentucky by the man who enslaved her. It was a man named John Clark. He had inherited her from his father. He brought her, her mother, and a number of other of her family members to Kentucky when he migrated there to settle in the very beginning of the 19th century. He bought land in Kentucky near a town called Cynthiana and settled there. He also brought his three children by his first marriage. His wife had died. On the way from Virginia to Kentucky, there's evidence, strong evidence, that he had intercourse with Betty, the young slave girl. She was 14 years old.
He was quite older.
He was in his 30s. And she became pregnant. And so by the time they got to Kentucky and settled first in Lexington, she was pregnant and then gave birth to her first child, a baby she named Michael. She had four more children by this slave owner. And they lived together. He never remarried. There's evidence that she had a very close relationship with his two daughters and with his son from the first marriage. And then he died, finally. I argue that she had been really waiting for him to die. I also made sure that in his will, she and three of her four children were manumitted, were given manumission papers or freedom papers.
That was the linchpin, that he did not free one of the children, and he knew that that would then tie her to that place.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The cruel irony, on the one hand, his giving her her freedom. He gave her that on the one hand. With the other hand, he pulled it back because her youngest child, the youngest child, was kept in slavery. And he was to be, according to the will, granted his slavery if he behaved well.
You're listening to a one-hour special with writer and historian Mary Fredrickson. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, more about the collection of stories inspired by escaped slave Margaret Garner, entitled Gendered Resistance, Women, Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner.
Thank you. channeled. You, floating above the crackle of bones, stepping in dry water, singing your question, how do I heal from this indelible wound? Ah, we wondered when you would ask. You have grieved now for 400 years, generations memorizing the failed self, drugged by your technology, tenderness left impotent, dancing in shackles you call handcuffs. Why do you dance our death instead of our life? Step into the water, child. Let the shackles slip from your soul. From the first ship to the last whip was for this moment. Our bodies were taken to render us unconscious, our cells filled with fear, and yes, we slept through our beliefs. But now you hold the seed. You remember? You know our full nature, not just the pain. Walk that memory. You submitted to the collective way. Walk that memory. Your law was the sacredness of life. Recall that sustenance. Walk that memory. Water this seed. The water connects you, blending memory and tomorrow. Womb water. It is your awakening now that we are waiting for. Your awakening. Your awakening. Awakening. Awakening.
Awakening. You're listening to Sojourner Truth. I'm your host, Margaret Prescott. Our guest is Miami history professor Mary Fredrickson. We are discussing the new anthology, Gendered Resistance, Women's Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner. I wanted to just quickly ask you, because I do want to get onto the Quadroon Bowls and Chica da Silva and a few other things. But when they were in Cincinnati, in Ohio, which was a free state now, in 1829, there racial tension arose and a lot of threats and riots by white mobs against black people, many of whom fled to Canada, and then again in the 1840s. And I wondered if you in your research knew why those particular years, I mean, 1829, what was going on that caused this thing to come to a head?
At the time, the African-American free black population of Cincinnati was quite small. It was somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people. And it made up a very small percentage of the overall population of the city. But having said that, there was tremendous fear that more and more slaves would escape from the South, come to Cincinnati, and settle. And you mentioned that Betty, who once she was free, insisted on being called Elizabeth Clark, and then when she married Elizabeth Clark Gaines, she and her family prospered. They did prosper. They were business owners. There were opportunities for free blacks in the city of Cincinnati. The white population knew that and didn't like it one bit. And they were absolute, you know, the horrible irony of this is many of them were abolitionists, but they liked the idea of freedom in the abstract, but having thousands and thousands of free slaves come to the city was something that they did not want to see happen. At the time of the first riot, racially based riot against free blacks in Cincinnati, half the African-American population of Cincinnati left. About 1,500 people left and went to Canada and settled. Elizabeth Clark Gaines and her family stayed. They held their ground there and waited it out. And things did get somewhat better. But as you say, in 1840, there was another major riot.
And in fact, the white mob set up a cannon on the street, which is quite remarkable, and fired
at Black people. Just an amazing story there. But I was also very moved. And again, this is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and our guest is Mary E. Fredrickson. She, along with Dolores M. Walters, edited the brand new book, Gendered Resistance, Women's Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner. You know, there's not a lot out there on women's resistance to slavery, and this book certainly is one of them. I was very moved by the story that is told, actually in your chapter, Mary Fredrickson, in the book, about Elizabeth Clark Gaines' first grandchild, Peter Clark. And he gave just an amazing speech, because he became an orator and an organizer, you know, on slavery and citizenship and workers' rights and much more, as you say. I just wanted to quote something from a speech that he gave in 1873, where he says, "I do not forget the prejudice of the American people. I could not if I would. I am sore from soul to crown with its blows. It stood by the bedside of my mother and intensified her pain as she bore me." And it further says, "It poisons the food I eat, the water I drink, the air I breathe. It dims the sunshine of my days and deepens the darkness of my nights. It hampers me in every relation of life, in business, in politics, in religion, as a father or as a husband. It haunts me walking or riding, waking or sleeping." And then he further says, "Hercules could have as easily forgotten the poisoned shirt which scorched his flesh as I can forget the prejudice of the American people." I was so struck by that, Mary Fredrickson. I am of African descent myself, from the Caribbean. And I thought that Peter back then captured so much, of course, the horror back then, but also to a much more limited degree, of course, the residuals of having to deal with racial prejudice and oppression. And when he was alive, the kind of terror that people went through. And here he was, the grandson of this woman who had calculated and made quite a fight to free herself.
Absolutely. And her sons and then her grandchildren became just, all of them were absolutely amazing people. Peter Clark, a remarkable orator. He spoke all around the state of Ohio and was very connected nationally. He became the head of the Black schools in Cincinnati. His uncle, one of Elizabeth Clark Gaines' children, had founded the Black schools in Cincinnati, arguing that if there were going to be schools for white children, there had to be schools for Black children. These were people who were absolutely saw education, business, religion, the church, the school, and the home as the foundation of American life for Blacks, for whites. They spoke so powerfully about equality and opportunity and fairness and justice.
Quite a remarkable legacy there of Elizabeth Clark Gaines. I also wanted to speak with you about the Quadroon Bowls and the role that it played.
The chapter in the book that deals with this is by our colleague Diana Williams, and she wrote her dissertation on the Quadroon Bowls. She actually has a book coming out soon on the Quadroon Bowls. And she included a chapter in the anthology, Gendered Resistance. She talks about these balls that were held in the early 19th century in many cities, actually, in the U.S. But the most famous city was New Orleans. I'll just read a short excerpt that she includes. A typical description of such balls appeared in the Providence Gazette on August 7th, 1820. "Every Saturday night is ushered in with splendid quadroon balls. None but quadroon ladies, that is, women of mixed blood, and white gentlemen are allowed to attend. those ladies are prohibited from marrying a white man, and they are too proud and high-minded to marry one of their own color. Consequently, in this land of sensuality, that is New Orleans, they become openly, without any degradation, kept mistresses, and will, it is said, while engaged, if it be for a week, a month, or a year, be true to their employers. It is also said to be the common practice of the mothers of such daughters to educate them for the purpose of pleasure and barter them away during their minority to the best bidder.
And they were often referred to as left-handed marriages, because clearly a lot of these men, men of means, you know, had their own wives and families.
In the case of the Quadroon Balls, often these women were second wives. They were shadow. They had shadow families in many cases. And this was incredibly prevalent. One of the things Diana Williams does in this chapter that I think is so powerful is that she examines how the Quadroon Balls have sort of had a second life in American visual culture in recent decades. There are films about the Quadroon Balls now. Anne Rice's second novel, A Feast of All Saints, features the Quadroon Balls. So there's interest in these stories and, quite frankly, in the sexuality and the intensity of these stories.
Right.
One of the questions that Diana Williams asked is how much power did these women have and did their families have? You know, because on the one hand, these women can be seen as caught in this system. Absolutely, they were this abusive system. On the other hand, their mothers leveraged this life for them, which in 1820, probably in qualitative terms, was a better life for them than they would have had as an enslaved woman who didn't occupy this particular liminal status as a quadroon.
I was interested that included in this anthology that you edited, one of the editors of, is a chap entitled Resurrecting Chica de Silva. And I first learned about her actually spending some time in Guatemala and Venezuela, actually. And Chica de Silva, the television soap opera, is huge. I mean, everybody wanted to run home to be able to watch Chica de Silva. And she was an enslaved woman, just to tell our listeners, who was born in 18th century Brazil, who was freed and got involved with a very wealthy man. And all of the soap opera is based on Chica de Silva and her manipulations and her you know, relationships with those enslaved beneath her, but also that here was this black woman wielding, at least the fictionalized version is portrayed as quite a lot of power.
Right.
Why include her in this anthology, that story?
Well, because one of the things that we're looking at, we are looking at various forms of gendered resistance. And mm-hmm. Chica de Silva was certainly an example of a woman who resisted and carved out a very powerful and precise kind of life for herself. Her form of resistance was to marry this wealthy man, have a legal marriage. She had 13 children by him. She inherited his estate, and she became very powerful. And she used her sexual power to turn the tables on the system. And I think, you know, one of the things that Raquel de Souza, who is an anthropologist and a scholar who trained at the University of Texas, Austin, and lives and works in Brazil and teaches there, one of the things that she wanted to do was to connect the modern soap opera about Chico da Silva and the actual historical figure, who is a very complicated historical woman.
Just before we leave it, because we do have to mention Harriet Tubman going back quite a bit, because Harriet Tubman, there was a whole big deal for women who were enslaved that they should not leave their children, that they have to stay with their children no matter what. Of course, some women did try to escape without their children, but a lot of women try to escape with their children. Now, Harriet Tubman, when she first escaped, she left her, I think, her husband and some other members of her family. And I guess a case can be made that part of her going back and so much involvement in the Underground Railroad, of course, was helping others, but also trying to get others of her family members out into free states. Mary Fredrickson.
Absolutely. And another of the chapters in the book by Vida Smith Tucker really looks at women as secret agents on the Underground Railroad, and women who worked as abolitionists, who in certain cases left their children, in other cases were single women who did not have children, but who were, like Harriet Tubman, absolutely committed to getting as many enslaved people out of the South as possible. She looks particularly at the story of Harriet Tubman, but also at the story of Mary Ellen Pleasant and Mary Bowser, three women who were incredibly deeply involved and committed to working as agents to get people out of the South.
There is a chapter in the book on art and memory, healing body, mind, and spirit. I'm delighted to see one of the contributors is S. Pearl Sharp. She actually is part of our team here at Sojourner Truth. She does our Sojourner Goes to the Movies. Justin, and wrapping things up, tell us a bit about the importance of that chapter in this anthology.
Well, I'll tell you, when we decided to put together this book, Dolores Walters was working at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center in Cincinnati. I have taught for a long time at Miami University in the Department of History and Women's Studies up there. And we wanted to bring together a group of scholars, and we wanted to engage our students and people in the community. And one of the ways that we thought we could do this most effectively, talking about gendered resistance, talking about sexual slavery, talking about intimate partner violence. How do you talk about these things and pull people into the discussion? And we felt very strongly that art and film and dance and storytelling and music were ways to do this. So we asked Carolyn Maslumi, who's a very well-known quilt artist, Nyla Randall Bellinger, a choreographer and incredible dancer out of Boston and New York, came down with her dance company and performed a dance she had choreographed called Dancing Beloved. Olivia Cousins and S. Pearl Sharp came and showed the most recent film that S. Pearl Sharp had made about the Middle Passage from Africa to the Americas.
Yeah, her book, her DVD, The Healing Passage, the film.
The Healing Passage, mm-hmm. That was shown. Our students responded to that very powerfully. And then finally, in this symposium, we had Catherine Roma, who is the director of Muse, which is an incredible women's chorus in Cincinnati, women's choir. And they performed a special list of pieces around the issue of gendered resistance.
Yeah.
So we found that we could pull students in, we could pull community members in. And that was our goal in having the symposium, and that really has been our goal in putting together the anthology. So it's a real opportunity to talk to you about it, and I hope many of your readers, particularly students and people who teach, will spread the word about this book.
Yeah, such an important story as well. Mary E. Fredrickson, one of the editors of Gendered Resistance, Women's Slavery, and the Legacy of Margaret Garner, thank you for doing this piece of work and editing this anthology along with Dolores M. Walters, and thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret. It's been a pleasure.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank our guest and the entire Sojourner Truth team. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.
KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO.